You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The winners of this year's Academy Awards will be announced this Sunday, and Oscar season always seems to trigger a bout of nostalgia for wonderful films from the past, films that are often much better than the ones that are up for this year's Oscars. Vanity Fair magazine has been running a series of behind-the-scenes articles about the making of some of those favorites, and now those pieces have been gathered into a collection published by Penguin Books, Vanity Fair's Tales of Hollywood, Rebels, Reds, and Graduates, and the Wild Stories Behind the Making of 13 Iconic Films is edited by Graydon Carter and includes stories by a number of the magazine's contributors. I'm pleased to welcome one of them, Sam Kashner, who wrote five of the articles to the show today. Hello, Sam.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
Now, one thing that the stories in this book all seem to revolve around is the element of chance. So many of these films wound up with different stars or different directors or different endings than were originally planned. Is movie success really that serendipitous?
Well, I mean, the funny thing is that I think it sort of is. I mean, it's almost, Mike Nichols feels it's almost fate, you know. He had the chance, for example, to cast Robert Redford in the role of Benjamin Braddock, the role that went to Dustin Hoffman in The Graduate.
Also, Candace Bergen was supposed to be in that film, and Ava
exactly,
Gardner?
Yes, that's right, as Mrs. Robinson. And Gene Hackman as Mr. Robinson, you know. It's like people recalling that Ronald Reagan would have owned Rick's Cafe in Casablanca, you know.
Well, you don't know whether the films would have been just as good. They would definitely have been different, but it's because those films have seemed to be so perfect with the casting they have that we wonder what the heck anyone was thinking.
Exactly. They're so good, and they just seem unimaginable with any other actors.
For example, Betty Davis wasn't the first or even the second choice to play to star in All About Eve. Claudette Colbert was the first choice?
Right. That's right.
Now,
why
didn't she do it? I think she might have been okay, although Betty Davis was perfect.
Well, right. Well, I mean, there was also, you know, the directors. This was also the beginning of the director, and Mankiewicz, Joe Mankiewicz, the director of All About Eve, was also a good instinctive casting agent, you know, and that also brought Davis's Gary Merrill, her husband, into the mix. So sometimes, you know, one actor creates a kind of chain reaction, and it's sort of a chemical reaction, you know, with the other actors. For example, in The Graduate, Gene Hackman just seemed too old to play, too young, I'm sorry, to play Mr. Robinson, you know.
Anne Bancroft's husband.
That's right, Anne Bancroft's husband in The Graduate, exactly.
Well, you mentioned Gary.
Yes, although, curiously, All About Eve is takes on another strange sort of cult status as being one of the few movies which Kenneth Anger calls it the three S's. There are actually three suicides in among the actors in All About Eve, which is kind of a record.
Wow, you know? Who are they?
Marilyn Monroe, which I guess is mm-hmm. arguable, but she was a suicide most likely, and George Sanders,
mm-hmm.
If you remember, also took his life with that famous suicide note that he was bored with life, and an actress called Barbara Bates who plays sort of the new Eve, who kind of impinges herself at the very end on Anne Baxter, and you realize, you know, you have to kind of watch your back, you know, someone's always gaining on you, and all three of those actors were suicides.
Now you mentioned that Gary Merrill and Betty Davis were in All About Eve. They were married to other people at the time.
That's right. Yeah.
And then romance plays a large part in a number of these stories. Another example, of course, is Liz Taylor and Richard Burton in Cleopatra.
Yes, the most famous adulterers on the planet when they were making Cleopatra. In fact, Elizabeth Taylor was denounced by the Vatican newspaper and on the floor of the House of Representatives, and wore her scarlet letter for a long time until they finally married about 2 years later. And that almost derailed that movie, which of course was the most expensive film ever made. And Joe Mankiewicz, who directed that film as well, is all about Eve, said it took two of everything to make Cleopatra, two directors, he was the second one hired, two studios. It was an incredible spectacle, just the making of Cleopatra was kind of unforgettable, and it was almost overshadowed, you're right, by the Burton Taylor romance, unimaginable.
So did Joe Mankiewicz have some kind of karma that led his stars to leave their spouses and marry each other?
Right. It happened in Mankiewicz's own life. In fact, he met his last wife on the set of Cleopatra, and his wife, a famous Viennese actress by the name of Rosa Stradner, came to Rome, and because she had heard rumors that Mankiewicz was involved with the script girl, and in fact, he kind of gaslighted her and denied it, but the relationship was well along, and he eventually would marry her.
Your account of the making of Rebel Without a Cause makes it seem like a hotbed of sexual intrigue. Is it true that part of the reason Natalie Wood was cast was that she was having an affair with Nicholas Ray, the director?
That's right, and she was a teenager.
She was 16 at the time.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
Then later she began an affair with Dennis Hopper, also in that film.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you really need a scorecard for that movie. I mean, but also I think Nick Ray encouraged that sort of turmoil and sort of anxiety. I mean, because he was a very cagey and smart fellow, and he knew that this was good for his movie.
Well, there's a lot of sexual ambiguity in that film, and I gather
exactly.
Ray also was involved with Sal Mineo. Is that possible?
Yes.
Not James Dean.
No, I think he. I don't know how he missed James Dean, but of course, Dean's sort of moody, troubled teenager was really modeled on Nick Ray. I mean, that was the revelation to me in trying to kind of reconstruct the making of that film was how the real genuine authentic rebel in that movie was its director, was Nicholas Ray.
And then James Dean died in a car crash just a week before the movie opened.
That's right.
Nicholas Ray was one of the great directors, and he had a big hit partly because Dean died, but hadn't they been planning to make more films together? It could have really changed Ray's career.
Oh, absolutely. I think Nick Ray was arguably, one of the greatest directors in America in any case. I mean, and in world cinema. But they had big plans. They were going to have a production company together, in fact. And Dean was set to play Billy the Kid, for example, which Arthur Penn did a decent job of it, and Paul Newman took over that part. But could you imagine Nick Ray directing James Dean in the Billy the Kid story? That really would have been just remarkable.
My guess is, Sam, I was just going to tell people that you're Sam Kashner, contributor to a book just out from Penguin called Vanity Fair's Tales of Hollywood, Rebels, Reds, and Graduates, and the Wild Stories Behind the Making of 13 Iconic Films. It's edited by Graydon Carter. What were you going to say, Sam?
Oh, no, I was going to say the other thing that I thought was kind of interesting about some of these films was also the kind of guerrilla filmmaking quality that they had, especially films like The Sweet Smell of Success, which was really, if you want to see what New York kind of looked and felt and smelt like in the 50s, particularly New York nightlife, that's the film to see.
Well, it's a cult film now, but it wasn't it didn't do well in the box office at the time. And is that because people weren't ready to see Tony Curtis and Burt Lancaster play villains?
I think that was part of it. Yeah, absolutely. Remember, they were kind of magnificent together in Trapeze, and it was kind of, no pun intended, it was an uplifting sort of story in a lot of ways. And the character of J.J. Hunsaker that Lancaster played, if you remember the film, is just kind of withering and scary. It's really a horror film on some level. He's just a monster, and it went far in bringing down Walter Winchell, the famous gossip columnist and sort of right wing. Gossip monger and newspaper yenta of the 30s and 40s and even 50s, and it kind of brought down his career. He tried to besmirch the film and gloried in its lack of financial success, but it had the last word and brought him down.
Well, I told Tony Curtis that I thought that he deserved at least an Oscar nomination for it, and he said, "They hated that movie. There was no way I was ever going to get a nomination for it." The Producers, which was turned into an enormously successful Broadway musical, was a modest film that got mixed reviews and didn't do well at the box office.
That's right. In fact, yes, that's right. And they even tried to Joseph E. Levine, who went on to produce, you know, more kind of respectable fare. He made his fortune repackaging those badly dubbed Hercules films with Steve Reeves, you remember from matinees and double features. He was the distributor of The Graduate, for example, and the producers. And but with the producers, he tried to pair it with porn films in porno houses. I mean, you know, he didn't have high hopes for that film at all.
Because of Springtime for Hitler, was it considered just too tasteless, too edgy?
Yeah. In fact, one producer said, "I think, you know, I'll invest in the film, but you have to change the title to Springtime for Mussolini," which doesn't have quite the same ring, you know.
I understand that Mel Brooks actually had written a novel called Springtime for Hitler, which he never completed, and who knows what would have happened if he had published that book.
Exactly. It's one of the things you were talking about earlier, you know, the sort of what-if factor, and that's right, and he kind of abandoned his novel and wrote this movie. He thought he would spend his whole life on television and writing for sitcoms, and you know, he started writing for Sid Caesar, and he really felt he would be consigned to television. But it was sort of he just went on his nerve that somehow this would make a good film. And then when they brought Zero Mostel into the mix, again, that kind of sort of magic or that sort of alchemy kind of started to happen. You know?
You also wrote about Saturday Night Fever. We're pretty much out of time, but are there any things you want to add before we go about that film or about some of the other ones that are covered here? The last film is Reds.
Right. Well, the Saturday Night Fever was one of my favorite films to cover, I guess, because it's somewhat more recent in memory, and I got to talk to so many of the principals who are still around, so it made my job a lot easier. But also, I was really struck by the tragedy in John Travolta's life while he was making that film. A woman named Diana Hyland, he was involved with, was dying of breast cancer. And a lot of that sort of confusion and hurt that you see on screen is also Travolta responding to the pain in his personal life, and how difficult the making of that film was, and also it had that sort of seat of the pants guerrilla quality, you know, another movie that people thought would be a little disco movie at the end of the disco craze that became a phenomenon and sort of changed the game. So you never know where you're, you know, where the big hit will come from ultimately.
Well, Reds, I know a little bit about Reds from an odd source. My sister worked for Dee Dee Allen, who was the producer and editor of that film. This isn't in the book, but Warren wanted Dee Dee Allen to edit the film, and she was resistant because she knew it was going to be a big mess. And then he offered her producer, and she took the job. And this is the way a lot of Hollywood works, isn't it? You make them an offer they can't refuse.
That's exactly right. Yes, yes. And sometimes it works out brilliantly, and sometimes notoriously. But
in the case of Reds, Dee Dee took what probably was slightly incoherent film and made it into something that made real sense.
That's right. Well, remember, you know, these films, as you suggest. Leonard, you know, Reds happen to have been a labor of love, but, you know, sometimes labors of love don't work out. You know, you can just look at Kevin Spacey's Bobby Darin movie or John Travolta's Scientology-backed film Battlefield Earth, you know, and you see that labors of love don't always work out as they sometimes fail to do in life as well.
Thank you so much for talking with us. Sam Cashner wrote 5 of the 13 stories in this book called Vanity Fair's Tales of Hollywood, Rebels, Reds, and Graduates, and the Wild Stories Behind the Making of 13 Iconic Films. It's edited by Graydon Carter and published by Penguin Books. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, for me too. Thank you.
Up next, Word Maven Patricia T. O'Connor takes your calls and questions about the intricacies of the English language. Start dialing now. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.